My name is David Wee. I serve Holden right now as one of the teaching staff coordinators with my wife, Karen. And I have spent most of my life as a college professor of English at St. Olaf in Northfield, Minnesota. One of the pleasures of my years of teaching is that I have been able to teach a course on baseball and American values to students for 25 or 30 years. And when I go to professional meetings of English professors and we all say, well, what do you teach, or Victorian literature, the medieval studies and so forth, nobody cares that I teach Victorian literature, but when I say I teach a course on baseball and American values, they say, you lucky guy, you know, how do you get to do that? Tell me about it, send me your syllabus and all of that. That's the most interesting thing I do to the outside world, and it is fun. And part of what I want to do tonight is to talk with you, and I'd like this to be interactive because I have a lot of questions, but not as many answers as collectively we have in the room, about baseball, tangentially sport in general, but in this country, baseball, I think, is the most interesting topic, the most interesting sport, especially for literature. And I'm a teacher of literature, and there are great novels about baseball, and many of our great writers have taken it up. So I'll get in a little while to the first two columns of words there, which are some of the subtopics that we take up in a course on baseball. We don't hit fungos and field grounders in the baseball class. We talk and think and read about baseball. Now, one of the things I do at the beginning of every class period, because as you remember your own jaundiced youth, college students don't always arrive right on time. So to give them a few minutes of grace, I ask trivia questions just to get them thinking. And I'll do a little of that with you tonight, just to show how we do it, and then take up a few other such details. The answer to the trivia questions are not nearly as important as the fact that these things could have happened at all. And that's part of the charm of baseball, is that the most bizarre kind of things happen. So here's a few, and please don't feel embarrassed, but most people can't answer these questions, even if they're lifelong baseball fans. Who hit into the only all-Cuban triple play?
Who hit into it?
Who hit into it? And several of these questions come from one of my favorite books, which is Who Was Harry Steinfeld? And other baseball trivia questions. The last question I'll ask you is, who was Harry Steinfeld? Who hit into the only all-Cuban triple play? Here's the answer. Dorrell Norman Elbert Whitey Herzog. You've never heard of his first three names, but we know him as Whitey. Whitey Herzog, outfielder for the Kansas City Athletics in the 1960s and later manager and general manager of major league teams. He was playing in 1960 against the Washington Senators, who a year later had the wisdom to move to Minnesota and become the Minnesota Twins. Their last year in Washington. And right now we have a legitimate team back in Washington again. You know, there was one briefly in the 70s, but now Washington appears to have a team again. The motto used to be Washington, first in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. Camilo Pascual was pitching for the Washington Senators. Whitey Herzog hit a line drive which turned into a Camilo Pascual to Julio Baquerto to Jose Valdivielso. Triple play. The only time in recorded history that all three fielders in a triple play were Cubans. Who hit into a triple play? Come on in. Yeah, come on through. Who hit into a triple play in his last time at bat in the major leagues? What a way to go out. And of course, it would be a player from a team of historic futility. This one actually was from the 1962 New York Mets. And I ran across a clipping describing it in the paper 10 or 15 years ago. Their last game of the season, the Mets were trailing the Cubs by a run at Wrigley Field going into the top of the ninth. Sammy Drake and Richie Ashburn hit singles. They're on first and second. Nobody out. And up comes Joe Pignatano. And he hits a looper behind second base, which looks like it's going to fall in for a hit. So the two runners are running like crazy. And the second baseman makes a spectacular catch and throws the second and relay back to first. And it's a triple play. End of game, end of season,
end of career.
I know how that feels.
But concluded in the story was Casey Stengel, the manager's response. They got back into the clubhouse at the end of the season in which they lost a historic record number of how many losses did they have that season? Anybody know?
52.
No.
300.
Yeah. Well, 100, it's a 162-game season.
120.
154-game season. They lost 120. Bingo. Never been matched.
And Mariners are working on it this year.
So Casey Stengel, talking to the deflated team back in the clubhouse, says, "Fellers, I don't want you to feel bad about this. No one or two guys could have done all this. It was a real team effort." Who hit a home run in his first at-bat in the major leagues and then in a 22-year career never hit another home run?
It's got to be a pitcher.
It's got to be a pitcher.
Tony Clonager?
No, not Tony Cloninger. He did something otherwise remarkable as a pitcher, but
American Leaguer or National League?
It was American Leaguer, pitched for the White Sox most of his career. Hoyt Wilhelm, pitcher. First at bat in the majors, home run, never again. 22 years. Okay, here's a couple of other weird ones. Which opposing pitchers have faced each other with the longest last names? Two pitchers with the longest last names. Now, when you think some people have too much time on their hands and figure these things out, you're right. This is Andy Van Landingham against Jason Isringhausen. Isringhausen is still pitching for Cardinals.
Cardinals.
But these two guys, 25 letters in their names combined. And some people care about that.
Sportscasters,
that's right.
Now, to win that category, you would have to have a total of the longest number of letters, or each of them would each have to have at least X, 12, 13, 14.
Well, there's two different categories. But this was their combined. Who had the best lifetime one-loss record against the New York Yankees?
Pitchers?
The pitcher with the best one-loss record against the New York Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
Did I hear?
Is it Babe Ruth?
It's Babe Ruth. Mm-hmm. Babe Ruth was the best pitcher the Yankees ever faced. They figured out how to get out of that one. Bought him.
Bought him.
And turned him into an outfielder and batter. And baseball has been different ever since. But what many of us forget or never knew is that Babe Ruth was the best left-handed pitcher in the major leagues at that time. And the Boston Red Sox, until their redemption last fall, you know, hadn't won a World Series since they got rid of Babe Ruth.
That's the curse. Right?
That's the curse, yeah. And last, who was Harry Steinfeld? Does anybody know? There's a famous poem that was written by a newspaper man back in 1908.
KCSF.
That was another, it's one of America's best loved poems, is Casey at the Bat. But in 1908, a newspaper man wrote this short jingle because his beloved Giants had failed against the Chicago Cubs, who won the World Series for the last time. These are the saddest of possible words, Tinker to Evers to Chance. Trio of bear cubs, fleeter than birds, Tinker to Evers to Chance. Ruthlessly pricking our gonfalon bubble, making a giant hit into a double, meaning a double play. Words that are weighty with nothing but trouble, Tinker to Evers to Chance. These were the shortstop, the second baseman, and the first baseman for the Cubs. They became so famous. I mean, they were good players, but because of this poem, and tell you all this because we all need to understand the power of poetry. Because they are together in this poem, they went into the Hall of Fame together, even though there were better second basemen and shortstops and so forth who aren't in there. Harry Steinfeld was the third baseman in that infield. He didn't fit into the rhythm of the poem. So he never made it into the Hall of Fame either. So that's who Harry Steinfeld was. Well, the answers to these questions, as I say, don't matter as much as the circumstances that actually happened. For instance, what major league player 1 year had his only hits of the whole year were home runs. Played all season. The only hits he got all year were home runs. Now this was, and you know, it doesn't matter that you don't know who it was, Clem Levine of the Brooklyn Dodgers, a pitcher. Again, you'd guess if this was a pitcher. Came to bat 31 times. Got only 3 hits, but they were all homers, which gave him a better home runs per at-bat percentage than Babe Ruth's last time. That's what happened with him. Well, books like this are full of, to some of us, interesting such questions. And then other things are happening every year. A couple of years ago, in one major league game, a pitcher pitched 4 strikeouts in 1 inning. Very rare, but it's possible. It can be done. And if anyone needs to know why, there are others here who can explain how that can happen. And that same year, there was a game in which there were no assists. That is, most baseball outs are caused by one fielder picking up a ball and throwing it to a teammate, and that's called an assist when the first baseman, for instance, catches the ball and the batter is out. Try to imagine a game in which there were no assists. Every out was a fly ball, pop up, or a strikeout, or a ground ball to the first baseman. Yeah, I can't remember who it was, but the fact that it could happen at all, you know, is just... it's not noticed by many people because few of us pay that much attention unless you're a scoreboard keeper, and then you notice because you study your scoreboard and discover this.
I remember a situation where Randy Johnson hit a seagull and the bird flew through. I'd never seen.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
I don't know how often that's happened in the life of baseball.
Yeah, yeah.
Twice. The odds of that.
Twice?
Twice.
Okay. Yeah. Both times in Seattle.
Well, no, this was down in Arizona.
Yeah.
Okay.
A seagull in Arizona?
No, it was not. It was a different bird.
Well, I need to tell you, and I'd be glad to hear from others of you, because people who don't love baseball wonder, you know, where does this come from? You know, how come you're such a baseball fan? And I can claim genetics. It's that simple. It had nothing to do with me, but it started with my grandpa, who was a Norwegian fisherman, who immigrated to this country in the last part of the 19th century, and became a Lutheran pastor of all things. He was from the most pious of the Norwegian synods, the Haugianer synod, and became a Lutheran pastor and then a seminary professor of Old Testament and Hebrew. And he died when I was 3, so I really didn't get to know him. But I've seen pictures of him. He was this stern, pious, tall, ramrod person who looked like he'd probably never smiled in his life. He became a fan of baseball. When I first started school at St. Olaf College as an undergraduate, several of my religion professors told me, when they knew that I had some interest in baseball, that Grandpa had been their Hebrew professor at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, and that during the first week of October every year, he canceled his afternoon Hebrew classes because he was in his study listening to the World Series. All the games were day games, there was no television, but he was there listening. And I asked my father, well, how did Grandpa get so interested in baseball? And he said that, as many people did in those days, Grandpa thought that most ball players were ruffians and ne'er-do-wells and didn't know how to do a legitimate work for a living. But he learned that Christy Mathewson, who was the greatest pitcher in the first couple decades of the 20th century, was a Christian young man who had promised his mother he would never play baseball on Sunday. That touched my grandpa. And then he learned that not only was he not a ruffian, but he was a graduate of a good liberal arts college, Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. So he began to pay attention to Christy Mathewson, and Mathewson was one of the greatest who ever pitched. So Grandpa got interested, took my father to ball games, and Dad tells a story that one time, the church sent my grandfather to Persia, now Iran, to check out a certain missionary who was doing apparently disreputable things over there, and Grandpa was there for a year just sort of checking out the whole mission scene in Persia. And in those days of poor communication and slow transportation, the family didn't know when he was coming home. And one Sunday, early afternoon, noonish, he walked in the door at the family home on the Luther Seminary campus in St. Paul. And there he was. And he went over and kissed Grandma, and he patted the children on the head, but didn't take off his hat and coat. Kind of ruffled through all the assembled mail on the buffet, and Grandma said, well, aren't you going to sit down and eat with us? And he said, well, on the streetcar coming up Como Avenue, he said, I saw that the Millers and the Saints were playing a doubleheader down at Lexington Park, and I thought I'd go. So he turned around and... So, you know, it's not my fault, you know, it came from the
It's just genetic.
Yeah, it's just genetic. Not so strange, though. Do you know what the United States government did to give appropriate compensation to the Iranian hostages after their 444 days of captivity in 79 and 80.
Yeah, they offered them World Series tickets.
World Series tickets.
Oh, it was better than that.
Season tickets.
Better than that. Mm-hmm. They gave them lifetime passes to Major League Baseball games. Yeah. Anywhere. And what more could a country do to somebody of the American way for a year and a half?
And how often does the American government get it that right?
Yeah.
Do you know who it was that said, haven't they suffered enough?
No.
It was a baseball, I don't remember who, but it was one of the managers.
Yeah. Anyway, then my father inherited this from his father, and when we lived in Chicago, I was 8 years old and discovered baseball, and Dad took me to a Cubs game at Wrigley Field, and that was it. Here I am. Teaching baseball courses my whole life. But that still doesn't answer the question for all of us. Can any of you quickly put a finger on why it is you care, or someone you love cares about baseball to an inordinate degree? Was it parental influence? Yeah?
When I was a little girl in Minneapolis, and my dad, I had a lot of brothers, but my dad and I went to the Minneapolis Millers games down on Lake Street. They were very, once a week or whatever, okay. They were there, and it's a real important type part of my dad and my life.
Yeah. So it becomes a family thing, okay?
Well, in the pre-Jackie Robinson era, for the African-American community, it was the Sunday afternoon social time to see and be seen. going to the ballpark. That was their place to be and be somewhat removed from the societal ethnic divisions.
Yeah. It was a place to feel that you are who you are, and you're playing a game with your own. And, okay, any others?
Well, this is sort of irreverent. My observation is people like to learn all those statistics so they can talk about them and, you know, show everybody how much they know.
Well.
I resemble that.
But why would that matter more than
I
being
really
able
don't
to
know.
Talk about the business scores?
It's a guy thing.
Not necessarily.
But it's not a guy thing. Every year but one that I've taught a baseball course at St. Olaf, the most knowledgeable student of baseball history was a woman student. And I'll say something more about that, but let's check the numbers thing. Here are some baseball numbers. And how many of you know what 2,130 represents?
Lou Gehrig's record.
Lou Gehrig's record
of
consecutive
games. This one, 2,632.
Cal Ripken's
new record of the number of consecutive games without ever missing.
Cal Ripken Jr.
Thank you, Cal Ripken Jr. What is .215?
Somebody's low batting average.
It is. It is somebody's. Mario Mendoza.
Oh, I remember Mario.
Yes. With sadness.
The Mendoza line.
Yeah. His lifetime batting average was .215, which for a regular player is really bad. Few players can stay in the lineup batting only .215. So his name just became legendary and associated with that figure, and it's called the Mendoza line, and every player desperately wishes not to have the batting average. 56.
Joe DiMaggio's hitting.
Joe DiMaggio, consecutive games.
Joe DiMaggio hit 56 consecutive games. What year?
50s.
Close.
What did he say?
1956.
1956, I was thinking 1957.
Three.
Not that recent. Let's ask another question. 0.406.
Ted Williams.
Okay. That, and what about Ted Williams? Besides that he hit that, what's significant about it?
That's the last
one to hit 400.
Over 400.
The last time any player has batted over 400 for a full season. They both happened in the same year. Well, somebody will think of it by the end of the hour. October 3rd, 1951. What
Coogan's
happened?
Bluff.
Pardon?
Coogan's Bluff.
Can you explain?
Bobby Thompson hit the home run off of Ralph Branca.
Yeah, all right. Bobby Thompson hit the home run off Ralph Branca on October 3rd, 1951. And
Giants win. The Giants win. The yep. Giants win.
This was the conclusion to one of the most incredible comebacks in baseball history. So that even if the Mariners should happen to be 13 and a half games behind, they're probably further than that.
Well, they are.
Oh, yeah, they are.
But the Giants were 13 and a half games behind the Brooklyn Dodgers on, I think, August 5th. They caught the Giants on the last day of the season. There had to be playoff. And on this date, and I bet you can remember where you were. If some of us here,
yes.
Anyway.
Yes.
Okay. I remember where I was when that home run was hit, and it won the pennant for the Giants and got them into the World Series.
And what was the bluff part of it?
Pardon?
What was the bluff part of it?
Coogan's Bluff was where the old Polo Grounds was located in New York.
Okay. Yeah.
The shot heard around the world.
Shot heard around the world is what it's called, which is, you know, just like the World Series is a misnomer. The shot heard around the world is a bit of an exaggeration, but for the baseball world, that was probably the most famous base hit that's ever happened in the history of baseball. And sadly, it was hit over the head of my childhood hero, Andy Pafko, his back pressed against the wall in the Polo Grounds as Thompson's hit went over his head. 1.12.
Who's
the
ERA?
Listen to all these.
Who's?
Who's the ERA?
Bob Gibson's earned run average for a full season starting pitcher. In what year?
68.
1968.
Okay. Is that the
lowest ever? I believe it's the lowest that starting pitcher, you know, who's pitched 200, 300 innings, has ever done for a season.
Isn't Roger Clemens somewhere around there this season?
He's been challenging me. This is about 1.34 right now. 0.3005. This is a batting average. Not rounded up as they usually are to three figures.
I'm trying. I'm trying to remember when. Who did,
right.
They were tied at 300, and they had to go to the fourth decimal to find out who actually won the bat.
This was the leading batting average. Also in 1968, Carl Yastrzemski won the batting championship, batting 301. It was actually just 300 and a half. The lowest batting average ever to win. And they both happened in the same year, and the result was, does anybody know what
lowered
major
league? The mound.
They lowered the height of the mound. In other words, to try to even, these two figures and other things that happened that year, like Denny McLain winning 31 games, made baseball decide the pitchers have too much advantage over the hitters. So they lowered the mound from how?
6 inches, I think.
5 inches, from 15 inches to 10 inches. So the pitchers couldn't have quite such an advantage over the batters. 511.
Home runs in a career.
Oh, no.
Cy Young wins.
I know you're close.
Both answers are right.
Is that the affirmation?
This is the number of lifetime wins that Cy Young had in his career. Now the award to the best pitcher in each league is called the Cy Young Award. And 363?
Cy Young's losses.
That's a good guess. It's a good guess. But this is the most number of wins by a left-handed pitcher in a career.
Warren Spahn.
Yep, that's it. Now, I've got to tell you a little story about 511. A few years ago, 3 years ago, I guess, I was doing a session like this at St. Olaf College for alumni on a recent weekend. And we were doing this, running through the figures, and I asked people to raise their hands if they knew the answer. So with a lot of these figures, you know, maybe a fourth of the group would raise their hands for some of them. But always a little 9-year-old girl was there. Her hand went up every time. A couple times I called on her and she knew the answer. But when I came to 511, hers was the only hand in the air. And I said, what is 511? And she said, well, that's the major league record for the most wins in a career by a pitcher, and it was done by Cy Young. Everyone's jaws just dropped. And then a man who I learned later was a 60-year-old lawyer from Chicago, and a Cubs fan, raised his hand and said, and by the way, that's also the number of career home runs that Ernie Banks hit in his career. Madeline's hand went up. She said Ernie Banks hit 512. And she was right. I was so excited by this that, you know, when the class was over, I just grabbed her and said, who are you?
Are you my lost child?
Well, David, give the reason Ernie Banks was her favorite player.
Yeah.
And tell the reason.
Well, she liked Ernie Banks because he was such an optimist. And he was one who always said, let's play two.
Didn't have anything to do with baseball. He was an optimistic person.
Somebody else hit 511 in their career.
Mel Ott,
right? So, you know, you were right about that, but the lawyer was wrong. Madeline was right. And during that class, I had, speaking carelessly, had made the comment that the Red Sox had traded Babe Ruth to the Yankees, and, you know, baseball history was changed. She came up to me after the class was over and said, Professor Wee, she said, the Red Sox didn't trade Babe Ruth to the Yankees. They sold him because the Red Sox owner needed money to produce the play. Now, I had known this, but I was just, that wasn't the point for this question, and I just wanted to point out that the Red Sox gave over Babe Ruth. But she had the grace not to correct the professor in front of the class. No problem correcting the lawyer sitting next to me. But she waited till afterwards, so I would not be, you know, mortified in front of the class.
We have to wonder where she is today.
Well, I know where she is. I got a couple months ago, after word of my retirement got out and she learned I was retiring, I got an email from her inviting me to a Twins game in honor of my retirement.
Oh. So,
you know, she's 12 now.
That's amazing. You wanted to be the new Twins manager.
Yeah. But a couple of other things about
tapping into what you were saying about why does somebody get to be like this? It was her grandpa.
Yeah, her grandpa and her dad.
And her dad liked it.
I had been following the Sammy Sosa Mark McGuire home run race in 1998 or whatever it was. And so she wondered why her grandpa and dad were so interested in all of this, and she started paying attention, and she has one of these absorbent minds. I invited her to teach the class with me as my co-teacher the next year, and she did. The news got out, and the newspapers picked this up, and television stations. So the two of us were interviewed by the Minneapolis television stations on the opening weekend of the baseball season the next year. And they're mainly interested in her, of course, which was appropriate. And the interviewer said, I can understand you get interested in baseball, but how could you possibly know so much information about baseball history? She said, well, at our house we have a lot of books, and I read them. Anyway, it was really fun teaching the class with her, and by the way, the Major League Baseball and the American Public Library System ran a contest a year ago to get kids into libraries taking out books, and it was a test or quiz on baseball questions. And Madeline answered her questions, mailed them in, and she had one of the perfect papers, and all the names of the perfect score people were pulled out of a hat at Wrigley Field by their manager, and they, of course, pulled Madeline's name out. Yes. And the prize was two seats for the World Series game, which was in Florida that time. But so she got introduced to the whole World Series audience, and it was great fun for her. She was hoping that the Cubs would make it to the World Series, but she isn't. But anyway, one of the newspapers ran a headline saying, growing baseball pays off. So, and you probably know, some of you, the quotation from Jacques Barzon, who studied American civilization, and said, anyone who wants to know the heart and mind of America had better learn baseball. So even a French sociologist, you know, coming to try to understand us, recognizes the importance of baseball. Now, one of the reasons I like to teach a class on baseball is that I think it's important for us in learning who we are as individuals and who we are as a culture to pay attention to why we care so much about sports and about baseball in particular. I have to ask myself, why do I spend more minutes a day reading box scores than reading poetry when I'm a professor of literature? Why do I go to more baseball games during the year than plays at the Guthrie Theater? The Twins, by the way, ran a campaign one year saying, if you want to see great plays, come to the Metrodome rather than the theater. But anyway, I do have to confess to that, and I'll tell you a little bit about some of the questions that we ask in the baseball course. It's not just trivia questions. These are, I take to be serious questions, and I urge you all to think about these things. Just before I do that, I want to read one page for you that was in the Newsweek. It was one of these little essays in the back of Newsweek in five years ago, 2000. It's entitled, "The Town That Gave a Man His Life Back." And here's another one of these stories about, you know, why is baseball significant? Why do we pay attention to it? This is written by Edith Hamilton. Every spring, when the umpire yells, "Play ball," in the first game of the season, I get teary-eyed again, wondering how that ball must have looked coming at my father on that pitcher's mound so long ago. It was a line drive in the summer of 1921. She's writing this 79 years later. A purely magic time for my father, who had been discovered by a baseball scout on a red clay ballpark in the Mississippi Hill Country. He was 26, newly married, playing pickup ball after work. Those of us who saw the movie last night, you know, are aware of what was going on in this decade. He was a southpaw, and family legend said Dad's blazing fastball was so hard it once split his brother's hand when he caught it. How a baseball scout ever heard of my father remains a mystery, but he gave him a minor league contract to play in Exeter, Nebraska in the spring of 1921. Exeter is a small town in southeast Nebraska where the plains begin. Its residents were crazy about baseball. They had a ball field and grandstands and intense rivalry with other minor league teams. My father's pitching statistics quickly made him a hero. My mother and their infant daughter, that is herself, a writer, now 80 years old. My mother and their infant daughter were feted by the townspeople with gifts and attention. The team was winning, and a regional title seemed certain as summer began to wane. Dad never talked about the line drive that shattered his ankle, ended his baseball career, and left him with a lifelong limp. In later years, he would show his grandchildren how to throw a curve or a slider, and in my mind's eye, I can still see their small fingers as he wrapped them around a baseball to demonstrate. But he never talked about that hit, capital T, capital H. I was an adult before I understood that most of us do not want to talk about our worst defeats. In 1958, while driving my parents to Kansas to visit my brother, I discovered that we were not far from Exeter, and I suggested that we drive there just to see the town that I had heard about all my life. My father protested that he did not want to go, but my mother and I persuaded him. When we reached Exeter, my parents were astounded. Interstate 80 had missed the town and the place was unchanged, quiet and serene. We were walking up the main street with my mother saying, "This is the cafe where we ate. This is the store where we bought our groceries." When we passed an elderly man who tipped his hat to us, stopped, did a classic double take, and came running back yelling, "Lefty Hamilton! You're Lefty Hamilton! You are, you are!" Don't ever tell me that baseball is not otherworldly. We went into a nearby cafe where the man got on the phone and began making calls. Soon a group of Lefty Hamilton fans, who had known my father 37 years before, hurried in and the party began. The laughter was so loud that the years seemed to vanish, leaving only that long-ago summer perfectly preserved in time. I sat back watching my parents. They looked younger. My father looked happily dazed. The words of an old song came back to me, "Memories, how they linger." The talk swirled around the tables. "How about that shutout game you pitched against, the day you balked, and that suicide squeeze?" When Dad expressed surprise that people still remembered him, a man replied, "Of course we remember. It's baseball, Lefty." As a lot of you have demonstrated, stuff you remember. I was dazed myself. These people, these wonderful people, still recalled my father, Lefty Hamilton, after all these years. He had pitched on a minor league team in a very small town for one brief summer season, and they remembered him. My parents' home had burned down years before the Exeter trip, and the only photo that survived the flames was one of my father and the Exeter baseball team. It is charred on three corners, a priceless memento, and looking at it used to sadden me because I felt something had gone out of my father's life that summer. To have a dream come true and then have it snatched away so quickly is more devastating than never having it come true at all. But the Exeter trip changed my father. It reassured him that he was not forgotten, that the name of Lefty Hamilton still lives in baseball's pantheon of players. This October, I'll watch the World Series, and I will forget the obscene salaries, the fields that resemble amusement parks under the lights, the rent-a-player late-season trades. I won't even think about the ticket prices that bar many fans from ever seeing a Major League game in person. I'll be caught up in the ageless pageantry of baseball. And when that first pitch crosses the plate, all my memories will be of Exeter, Nebraska, a little town that gave a man's life back to him. Now, those of us who saw the movie last night, Field of Dreams, it's the same kind of thing. It's about dreams being fulfilled or unfulfilled, the desire to have them accomplished, and in the movie, at least, it's baseball also that makes it all happen. So here are some of the things we talk about in a baseball class in college. And these are questions that I urge you all to think about, you know, talk about from time to time, because the answers to them will help us understand ourselves and our nation. Why do so many American novelists, this is the literature part, use baseball as a framework for their stories? What kinds of themes or topics do they address? Why is there a baseball book published every day of the year? You know, over 400 baseball books published in this country every year. Why all this literary? Now, not all of these books should be deemed literary, but there's so much publishing about baseball, and some of it is really good writing. Language. Why have so many baseball terms become common expressions? To get to first base on this, start listing the baseball terms you can think of. And why were nicknames so important in baseball? And how they become that way in other sports. But if we had another half hour to be together tonight, we could clear the boards and start listing all of the baseball terminology that has become part of our regular vocabulary. I was born with two strikes against me. I can't get to first base with her or
him. Struck out.
Huh?
I struck out.
I struck out again. One of my favorites comes from the Democratic National Convention in 1980, I guess it would have been, when, or 1990, when George Bush the Elder was running and had already been nominated by the Republicans, and now the Democrats were having their nominating convention, and the governor of Texas was the keynote speaker, and she was trying to emphasize the privileged nature of George Bush's background. And she said, George Bush was born on third base, but he thinks he hit a triple. And well, it's we use baseball terms very much. Religion. We talk a lot about religion and baseball. Why are so many Americans devoted, and I use the term intentionally, devoted to baseball and to certain other sports? Why do we care so deeply? Is there anybody here who feels better on the days that the Mariners or the Cubs or the Twins win and just feel a little more emotionally flat when they don't? Nobody confesses to that. I mean, I do. It, you know, it matters a lot. Why do we make pilgrimages? Why do we make pilgrimages to sacred places? You know, there are people who want visit every Major League Baseball park. People want to get to Fenway Park or Wrigley Field, and mostly we call it a pilgrimage, or to Cooperstown. We acknowledge the kind of central importance of this to us. Economics. Why And how do we devote so much public and personal money to professional sports? How have baseball and other sports moved marginalized people into the economic mainstream? You know, there's both negatives and positives that have happened, but almost every major league city has had, you know, big controversies over whether we need a new stadium, we've got to have a dome on it, or we've got to have open air, and thousands of dollars committed to stadium while we can't pay our teachers and we can't provide social services to the needy. Why do fans associate themselves with one team and remain loyal forever? Or, in contrast, why do some of us switch our loyalties to whatever team is nearest at hand? And I've come to think that the world is divided into two camps about this. There are people in Brooklyn who are Dodgers fans forever, even though 50 years ago they moved 3,000 miles away. And others who like the team who is close at hand and who are being written up in the papers and who you can actually go and see play. Why do cities go crazy when our teams win the championship? Karen and I had tickets to the World Series in both 1987 and 1991 when the Twins not only won the pennant but won the World Series. And after the seventh game, we were dancing in the streets, you know, and it was there was no sense in trying to get your car out of the parking lot, so we just danced with everybody else until not quite dawn. But what is it that makes us devoted to these players who are really hired mercenaries and who basically go, you know, as A-Rod has done, for those of you Seattle people, first one team and then another, and, you know, makes a horrible amount of money. Ethics. Do sports teach character? Just observe, you know, what we see on the playing field. What character do sports teach? How do sports promote a code of ethics or violate the codes of ethics that we hold dear? Why do some athletes try to get away with anything they can to win? And, you know, this is with us every year. You know, right now it's Rafael Palmeiro and the drug scandal. A couple years ago I was driving out here to Holden and I was reached by telephone in Deadwood, South Dakota by a USA Today sports reporter who wanted to know my opinion on Sammy Sosa and his corked bat. Every year there's some other crisis about this. History.
What was it?
I'll explain that later. He agreed. He had already written his column by the time we connected, and I told him what I thought he should have said, and he said that's it for heroes. In what way has baseball developed alongside other parts of American historical progress? How did baseball begin? Baseball has its own controversy over mythology of its origins and so forth. Is baseball really the American pastime, as it's been called? Why or why not? You know, some people claim, of all things, you know, that professional football or basketball or hockey or soccer, you know, is a more important, more American sport than baseball. In what ways can we argue for or against, you know, the claims we make as baseball being America's game? Metaphysics. Philosophy here. Consider how the game of baseball works, you know, the way it differs from other games. Most games work where, especially games played with an object like a ball or a puck, where you try to invade enemy territory. So it's a very territorial, we set up a wall against your invading army and we have body contact. That's not the way baseball works. In baseball, you take a walk, or you hit the ball and come home. Trot around the bases and come home, untouched. There's not body contact in baseball, but the whole concept of it is quite different.
Defense has the ball.
That's right. The offense cannot touch the ball in baseball. This is totally different from most sports. So there are some elements of this game that are really important to think about as a sort of game. Aesthetics. Is baseball beautiful? In what ways is it beautiful? A lot of us, you know, are glad to talk about that. And if you make a pilgrimage to one of these parks and walk into a stadium that you haven't seen before, it takes your breath away for some of us. A couple more things. Statistics. Why are numbers so important? This is your question. Why do we care? In the movie last night, Terrence Mann was holding the Baseball Encyclopedia, huge fat book in the movie. Karen always gives me a bad time because the biggest book in my library is the Baseball Encyclopedia. And maybe it is for some of you as well. But, you know, I have one in my office and one in my study and one in my living room. Why do we care so much about looking up the numbers or, you know, knowing these kinds of things? There are a few games in which everything is counted as much as they are in baseball. Sociology. What role does baseball and other sports play in our social arrangements? The development of cities, the survival of small towns, race relations, the status of females in our culture. Think about these issues. Why are there no women playing Major League Baseball or even umpiring? Race relations. This will be my last main story because it's time to quit. See, baseball doesn't have a clock. The games don't end with the bell, and it's hard to stay on schedule, but I'll stop in just a moment. One of my favorite baseball stories has to do with when Jackie Robinson became a Major League Baseball player in what year? 1947. First time in modern history that a black person had been allowed to play with the white guys in Major League Baseball. The Brooklyn Dodgers, with whom he played, made their first trip through the South and went to St. Louis to play the Cardinals, which was really the furthest South team there was in the major leagues at that time, the only Southern state. But the very large black population in St. Louis, finally one of their own was going to be playing in Sportsman's Park, I suppose it was then, playing in the Cardinals stadium instead of playing the Sunday afternoon out in other areas. Jackie Robinson was coming. And the day before the first game, the St. Louis Cardinal players said, "We will refuse to take the field against the team that has a black man playing for them." And Ford Frick, who was president of the National League and had virtually the same powers as the commissioner of baseball, Ford Frick sent a message to the St. Louis team and said, and this again is reminiscent of the movie we saw last night, "If you men do not take the field tomorrow and play against the Brooklyn Dodgers, none of you will ever play another Major League Baseball game in your life." Mm-hmm. And he had the authority to do it and the courage to do it. Averted a race riot, the Cardinals played the Dodgers, and as we say, the rest is history. And, you know, we've integrated baseball sooner than the national government was able to do it with the Civil Rights Act. And then the last thing, art, film, music, theater. There's a lot of wonderful things in those areas. The movies are wonderful. A couple of years ago, the Tony Award was won about a game about homosexuality in baseball. It was the best play of the year. So baseball is all around us. we use metaphors about baseball every day. I've heard a couple of them in the village. The person using them yesterday probably wasn't even aware that it was a baseball metaphor, but we all do that. And it's in our language, our literature, and many of us are very religious about baseball, collecting holy relics, getting that autograph signature, catching a foul ball in the stands. I mean, really, so what? But people break their legs, you know, leaping to catch a foul ball. In the
or other people's legs.
Or other people's legs, or at least spilling beer out. And collecting baseball cards, as I do, and all that sort of thing. So I hope this gives you food for thought, and thanks for coming, and enjoy the rest of the evening, and be glad to talk. Otherwise, you're good.
This is an impossible request, but I think it anyway. I mean, is there a capsule explanation from Dr. Lee about the why?
Why we care so much?
Yes.
It's very complex. It involves so many of these things. Part of it is aesthetics. I think it's a beautiful game. I love the numbers. I'm not a math person, but I love the way in which the numbers allow us to compare and note people's progress and see records being broken. Simply knowing the stories of baseball and having the memories, as in Exeter, and going to baseball with my father.
My answer, I think, is that it would vary from person to person, yeah. But I know David responds to the aesthetics of it. He likes the green field, mm-hmm. He likes the space that opens up, and he carries a baseball, the sphere, in the car.
There's no human invention that's much more pleasing to the touch
than a baseball. And other people wouldn't do it for that, but yeah. They might do it because they went with their father when they were young children.
But my answer is no better than any of yours, and I just urge you to think about it and be aware of how you behave and how we behave as a culture, and think about those things.
Remember, no
thanks.
There's no crying in baseball.
So what was the 56?
Talking about
56, Joe DiMaggio.
Joe DiMaggio was consecutive.
What was the number that we couldn't figure out what it was?
Sure.
Was it the 406?
No.
I was just going to. There was a number up there that we didn't know what it was. The 215.
that was the Mendoza line.
Okay, which one was it? He said he'd come back to it.
We did destroy it.
Okay.